So I know Jaws did not plan it this way, but after the last few weeks and all the revelations of the rampant sexual harassment in industry after industry, including our own, seems like there is never a better time that we needed to be with each other and amongst each other, to support each other, to bolster each other, to hold each other up, and to affirm each other like it is right now. So nothing gives me more pleasure than to be standing here tonight in this room full of kick-ass women journalists and enjoying the pleasure of your company. Think of all that it took for us to get here. All the hard work, all the sacrifices, the self-doubt, and the doubt from men who did not think we were supposed to be here in the first place. For many, many of us, we truly are not supposed to be here because someone didn't think we were smart enough or good enough or that women should be doing the types of jobs that we wanted to do. We've been passed over. We've been neglected. We've been harassed simply because men take our genders and bodies as license to show us just how much they believe we should not be in the spaces that we are in. So if it's not some type of cosmic, karmic, God may very well be a woman, divine justice, that Harvey Weinstein was brought down by the unflinching and dogged and meticulous reporting of two badass women journalists, then I don't know what is. You see, we belong to a profession that exists to hold power to account, a profession that sees itself as the righteous vindicator of the vulnerable. And this past week, we've been tragically reminded that our profession also has a darker side. This week, we've watched as some icons of media have been exposed for the way that they have wielded their power in ways that have abused and demeaned women. And I'm sure many women in this room understand this experience firsthand. And we know that while women account for half of all journalism students, in newsrooms across the country, men still remain overwhelmingly in positions of power, and they often can wield that power in unscrupulous ways. And because this is the experience of so many journalists, we women journalists have felt, or someone has tried to make us feel, that we are not supposed to be here. But we are here. And if ever there was an example of that, of the woman who wasn't supposed to be here, it is me, the woman lucky enough to stand here before you in this room today. Because this has been the story of my life. Teachers, guidance counselors, college professors, employers have through the years underestimated me and my worth and what I could do in this profession. They didn't think I was supposed to be here, and I've always used that as motivation. But in truth, in many ways, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm the child of a black man born into a sharecropping farm in Greenwood, Mississippi in 1946. At a time when black Southerners had virtually no legal rights in the country of their birth. The hospital in Greenwood refused to serve black people, and so my father's grandmother had to deliver him in a shack in the sharecropping plantation where he and his family had worked for a generation. My grandmother was a black woman born in the Mississippi Delta, married to a man who beat her, destined to live her life picking cotton for white plantation owners who had replaced slavery with a system of peonage that tied black people to the land and kept them destitute. But clearly, my grandmother was a woman who refused to stay in her place. And so one day she gathered her three young children, and with nothing but a suitcase and a bag of cold chicken, she got on a train that was northbound and headed to Iowa, where she got off hoping to raise her children with nothing but a dream that her children were not going to grow up picking cotton like she did. Sadly, what she found was a segregation and racial discrimination that looked very much like what she thought she had left behind in the South. She was forced to find work cleaning the homes of white people and cleaned for other people her entire life until she retired. My grandmother would not have dared to dream the dreams that I dreamt as a little girl, but she sowed that seed that would allow me to stand before you today. I remember as a child seeing how hard she worked, how hard my aunts and uncles and my neighbors worked in beef packing plants and in factories, and understanding that my community that I saw rarely matched the way that black people were portrayed in television and in newspapers. I read newspapers and magazines as a young child because I know it's hard to believe since I'm so fabulous right now. But I was a rather nerdy kid. And starting in middle school, I asked my parents to subscribe to Time Magazine and to Newsweek because I was always very curious about the news. I loved to read and keep up with current events, but I was also really curious and skeptical. It was me, unfortunately, who broke the news to my older sister that Santa Claus did not, in fact, exist. And I stumped my mom at the age of 10 when I told her I didn't want to go to confession anymore because I didn't understand why I had to talk to the priest instead of just going directly to God. But I was also curious about bigger, more important questions. I wanted to know why the black side of town had fewer places to shop and fewer places to eat, and why the houses got nicer and nicer as we crossed the river dividing the white part of town from the black part of town. I wanted to know why I had to ride a bus 2 hours every day outside of my neighborhood just to get into a good school. Why was it like that? Who made it that way? I never assumed that I knew the answers, but I wanted to find out. So I started writing for my high school newspaper, and I penned stories about students like me, black kids who were bused into a white high school where we often felt like we didn't belong. Many, many of you, I'm sure, know this experience. From the very, very first time I saw my byline, I was hooked. But more than that, when I looked around and I saw classmates of mine who never read our high school paper because it never reflected students like them, suddenly reading the paper because they were reading the articles that I wrote, I knew that this was my calling. But even though I was one of the top students in my high school, my guidance counselor only saw a black kid from the wrong side of town. So he suggested that I should apply to community college because that's where kids like me would attend. That's when I stopped going to him. And I stopped talking to him about my college plans. Instead, I applied to the University of Notre Dame on my own, and I didn't tell him until I got accepted. And then I took my acceptance letter in and showed it to him. It didn't take long, though, before Notre Dame also showed me that I wasn't supposed to be there either. It was at Notre Dame that I was called a nigger for the first time. Even now, when I think about that night, it takes my breath away. But once again, I used other people's perceptions of me as my motivation. I studied hard, and I graduated more determined than ever to work on issues of racial justice for kids like me. Notre Dame didn't have a journalism program at the time, so I majored in history and African American studies. It was great for my own personal edification, not so great when I was trying to find a job. I could write really long papers, and I knew a lot of random historical facts, but somehow employers didn't find those to be very marketable skills. So I got a job working in college admissions for a small college, and I earned so little that I had to take a second job as a sandwich artist at Subway. That's what we called ourselves, okay? It was humbling to be making sandwiches for minimum wage with a degree from the University of Notre Dame. But I've always been really thankful for that experience, and I hold it with me always because I've never forgotten the way that some customers treated me and talked to me because they assumed they knew everything about my worth by the job that I had. In fact, I worked two jobs until I was 30 years old. At one point, working as a school's reporter by day and selling mattresses by night just to pay my bills. That feeling is something that I've always held close, and it's been invaluable to me as a journalist, because there's no person that I can't talk to, and I don't give any more esteem to the CEO of a company than to the janitor who has to clean the buildings at night. Because when I look at that janitor, I see my own grandmother, and I see myself. After working for a few years, I decided to apply to school for journalism. I applied to the University of Georgia, but I didn't get in. They clearly didn't think I was supposed to be there either. And that rejection, like every rejection in life, hurt. Luckily, I did get into the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And then last year, I was awarded the Peabody Award, the highest honor in broadcast journalism. Now, as many of you may know, the Peabody is administered by the University of Georgia. So that felt kind of good. And my husband told them I should write them a letter and remind them how they had rejected me back in 2003. But I actually believe more in the Beyoncé philosophy of life, which I'm going to alter just a little bit. She says your best revenge is your paper. I say your best revenge is your success. There wasn't any need for me to write them back and tell them about their mistake because college admissions officers make a lot of decisions about who to expect. It was, though, my job to take every rejection and turn it around into a way of proving people wrong who underestimated me. While I was a student at North Carolina, I got an internship at a small newspaper in that state where I somehow managed to convince them to let me write 70 words on lynching. I still don't know how I did that. My mom sent me that clipping the other day, and I was pretty shocked that they let me do that. And I thought I did a good job for them. And after the internship ended, I applied for a 2-year minority internship program at a newspaper that shall remain unnamed, but if you look at my resume, you'll know where it was. And I listed my editor there at the at my internship as a reference. I didn't get that 2-year minority internship program. And later, the recruiter called and told me that the reason I didn't get it was because the editor had told them that he was concerned I was too biased, that I wanted to write about race too much, and he was concerned that I wouldn't be able to be an objective reporter. I was shocked by that. The recruiter warned me, next time, don't put someone down as a reference if you don't know what they're going to say about you. Except, I thought I did know what he was going to say about me. And I trusted him, and he had never raised a single concern to me about that fear. But I also was really worried that a newspaper would so willingly dismiss a young black reporter because she wanted to write about race. I went on and got a job as an education reporter at the News and Observer, and it was fantastic. I had a wonderful editor by the name of James Schiffer, who believed in me and who taught me and who mentored me, and he let me write about school segregation and racial inequality without everyone saying these stories were not important and that I shouldn't tell them. And a few years later, that reporting led the same newspaper, who declined to hire me in their 2-year minority internship program, to hire me as a regular full-time reporter. But if you can get the theme of my talk tonight, it didn't take long before I realized that some of the editors at that newspaper didn't believe I belonged there either. I was a black reporter who grew up in a working class family, and I wanted to tell stories about people like me and other marginalized groups. It always seemed like there were plenty of other reporters who were writing about white folks. I wanted to write about us. But my editors didn't want that, and I was penalized. My story ideas were rejected. I was called into meetings, and I was told point blank that I was writing too much about black people, and that was hurting my career. I wondered when, if ever, a single white reporter had ever been called into any room in the history of reporting and been told, "You're writing about white people too much." And I watched as nearly all of my friends who were journalists, one by one, left the industry behind out of frustration, who were journalists of color, I'm sorry. And then I got a breakthrough. A former editor of mine named Steve Engelberg had left to found ProPublica, and one day he called me and he asked me to apply. Not only did he let me write about racial injustice, he gave me the freedom to do it how I wanted and to spend months and months on subjects like housing and school segregation that no one else seemed to care about. 3 years later, the New York Times called and offered me a job for doing the exact type of work that I had been penalized for doing in the past. Funny thing is, I never even applied to the New York Times. In fact, it's probably hard to believe, but I never even aspired to work at the New York Times. I'm a black girl who grew up on the wrong side of the tracks in Waterloo, Iowa. I just didn't dream that high. The only thing I really wanted was to work for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and write about black folks in the South, and they would never hire me. Apparently, they didn't think I belonged there either. That's okay. I think I've done pretty okay for myself. So I don't tell you all these stories to say that everyone, if they persevere, story will turn out like mine. I'm lucky enough to be here, and I know that a lot of other hardworking journalists who work hard or harder than me, who are smart or smarter than me, weren't able to make it to the places where I've been. And also, because I'm a woman who always believes calamity is right around the corner, I don't know how long I'll be here. So I'm not staking claims on anything other than where I am right now. I know that a lot of brilliant, hardworking journalists had their careers derailed particularly women, by people who simply did not believe in them. I know of so many brilliant and hardworking journalists who never got a chance to show the work that they really could do. So what I hope is by telling you my story is to tell you, I don't know if you'll make it ultimately to where you want to be, but if you do, you can do so without compromising who you are and your sense of self. There's not a lot of people at the New York Times who look like me. There's not a lot of people who get on television as serious reporters who look like me. But I think it's so important for young women to see someone who looks like me, who comes from where I come from, and to know that you can be exactly the person that you are and still get to be at the place that you didn't even dream that you were good enough to be at. I started my career at an organization, the News and Observer, run by a woman, Melanie Sill. I was lucky for that. And I've been mentored and guided by amazing women throughout my entire career. All of our paths have been made easier by hundreds of pioneering women who came before us, some of whom are sitting in this room right now. They were determined to go into and then to thrive in places and spaces where people did not think they were supposed to be. And so I believe profoundly that we should be the person we needed when we were trying to make it. Be for someone else the person that you could have used when you were trying to make it. No one's looking out for us but us. We must stand up for each other. We must advocate for each other, promote each other, and build each other up. White women, it's not enough to have solidarity because you're a woman. Some of the editors who have disappointed me the most, who if I had to fight against the hardest, were not white men, but were white women. So I implore you, you must acknowledge the particular struggles of your black and brown sisters and use whatever power you have to support and advocate for us as well. It's one of the reasons why I helped to found the Ida B. Wells Society for Investigative Reporting last year. I imagine like the founders of this organization got tired of all the excuses. I got tired of hearing why we can't find investigative reporters of color to do this most important work. I got tired of hearing, oh, we'd love to, but they're just not there. And so I stopped waiting for other people to do something about it and decided to do something about it myself. And if there was ever a kick-ass woman journalist, it was Ida B. Wells. Let me tell you, if you don't know about this woman was born into slavery, orphaned as a child. She was run out of Memphis for daring to investigate and expose the real cause of lynchings. Was not black men raping white women, but white men determined to keep black people in their place. This was a woman who turned down all of her suitors until she found a husband who was as feminist as she was. A woman who refused to be put in the back of the line by white suffragists who were willing to segregate marches for women's rights in order to try to gain rights for themselves. Instead, she elbowed her way to the front of the line and dared those white women to tell her to get to the back. This was a woman who hyphenated her last name long before it was in vogue, who postponed her wedding several times because she had work to do, and who took her newborn baby out on the trail with her because there was reporting to be done. She lived her whole life in spaces where people did not think she belonged, and she did not give a single damn what people thought about that. So I always remind myself, whatever I think is hard, it wasn't hard. Whatever I might be going through, I didn't have to go through that. And if she could do it, we know that we can do it. We stand on her shoulders. We stand on the shoulders of all those women who came before us. And if there's anything that has reminded us how far we still have to go, it's been this last week. But it's also good to remember that we've always fought and will continue to fight and we will continue to win. And so ladies, I'm again honored to be with you here tonight. I hope my words may have provided a little bit of inspiration to go forth and keep doing the work that we must do. And before I go, I'd like each of you to turn to a kick-ass woman next to you and tell her, we're not supposed to be here. Do it now. And excuse my French, but then tell them, but we're f***ing here. All right, last thing. Turn to that woman and give her a big high five, and then buy me a drink later. Good night.